This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
February 1836, Santa Anna issued a proclamation to his troops, stressing the reason for their hardships on their march north. He said, "Our most sacred obligations lead us to these deserts and necessitate combat with a rabble of wretched adventurers upon whom our authorities have incautiously lavished benefits, not even offered native Mexicans. They," and he was meaning the Texas colonists, "appropriated this fertile and vast area, persuaded that our internal dissensions would prevent our defense of this part of our native soil. The miscreants will soon realize their stupidity." And how did he plan on dealing with the Texan stupidity? Well, Santa Anna communicated his intentions in a communication to Villosa on February 27, 1836. In it he wrote, "After taking Fort Alamo, I shall continue my operations against Goliad and the other fortified places so that before the rains set in, the campaign shall be absolutely terminated up to the Sabine River, which serves as the boundary line between our republic and the one of the North." Santa Anna intended to drive the Texans from the area and back to the United States. During the runaway scrape, as people fled their homes towards the Sabine, they were helping facilitate his goal. Except the rains had already come, and it made the process difficult. Now, there are several interesting accounts of the runaway scrape, and in the near future, I hope to share a couple of them. And the following is the account shared by a man named Creed Taylor. Taylor was born in 1820 in Alabama, and he was one of several children of Josiah and Hephzibah Taylor. Apparently, his father was a relative of General Zachary Taylor. Creed's father, Josiah, had served in the Gutierrez-McGee expedition as a captain, and so he'd already been in Texas, and he was a participant in the battles at La Bahia, Alazan, Rosales, and the horrible Battle of Medina, which was the largest and most deadly battle ever fought on Texas soil. So, several years later, when Creed was 4 years old in 1824, Josiah brought his family to Texas and settled in DeWitt's colony. At the age of 15 in 1835, Creed had participated in the come-and-take-it moment at Gonzales, and also took part in the Battle of Concepcion. He was at the grass fight and at the Siege of Bear. And in late January 1836, he was with the Texas forces at San Patricio and served as a scout and a courier until March 1st, when he was ordered to join Colonel James C. Neal at Gonzales, where they were gathering to go in aid of the people at the Alamo. But after news of the Alamo reached them, Taylor went to lead his mother and family to safety in the event called the Runaway Scrape. And he left his account in 1900, 6 years before he died, with a man named James T. DeShields. Taylor had a long history in Texas, and he fought with the Texas Army at Buffalo Bayou, fought at the Battle of San Jacinto, And in 1840, he was at the Battle of Plum Creek against the Comanches. He fought with John C. Hayes at Bandera Pass in 1841. He was also at the Battle of Salado Creek in 1842. He served in the Mexican War as a member of Samuel H. Walker's Texas Mounted Rangers, and he was at Palo Alto. He was at Resaca de la Palma and Buena Vista. And he also served with John S. Rip Ford in the Confederate Army in the 1860s. And he lived a nice long life despite all these dangerous situations he put himself in, and died in 1906. But, like I said, not until after he had left some of his reminiscences of his life in Texas. And part of that is his account of the runaway scrape, which I'm going to share now. Now, this account has been edited up to the point of the news about the Battle of San Jacinto. We jump ahead in the account that he gave to the account of going home. So there seems to be a little bit of a disconnect in the story there, but that's just because there's a large part that's been taken out to compress the runaway scrape narrative that Cree Taylor shared. And Taylor shared the following: "A true account of this colorful episode, including all of its pathetic incidents, has never been written, and I suppose now will never be given to the world. What I shall tell may add some interest to the story of this memorable stampede. To understand the magnitude of the intense alarm and unparalleled panic that seized the people in March 1836, one should note the causes leading up to the Great Exodus. It will be remembered that in that day we had no telegraph lines to flash the news over the country, no railroad trains, and comparatively few newspapers. All intelligence was carried by private conveyance from lip to ear, from settlement to settlement, and like all reports of an alarming or sensational nature, they grew as they traveled until the three small black specks became three black crows, and the report of Santa Anna's ruthless march was not lacking in side embellishments of Mexican inhumanity. That the public mind was wrought up to the utmost intensity will be readily inferred when we reflect that the proud dictator had threatened to drive every American out of Texas, to shoot everyone found with arms in their hands, to destroy all their property, and when he had made his coffee with water from the Sabine, return in triumph to his capital. San Antonio had been occupied, the Alamo had fallen, and its heroic defenders put to the sword. Then had followed Refugio, San Patricio, Goliad, and the horrible butchery of the noble and brave men who had dared to oppose the tyrant's advance. These calamities drew the pall of mourning over every home in the land, since I might truthfully say there was scarcely a family west of the Brazos which did not lose a member in one of these tragic affairs. With heroic fortitude, the people bore their misfortunes, buoyed with the hope that the handful of volunteers at Gonzales, the little ray of hope for Texas, would make a determined stand and in some way halt and crush the arrogant dictator at one fell blow. They had faith in these tall men with long rifles. With this cherished hope, those noble pioneer mothers and children waited and prayed for the return of their husbands, fathers, sons, and brothers. But sad, dark days soon came. All seemed lost, and then ensued that helter-skelter skedaddle, the Sabine Shoot. My mother told me that for several days men in small squads passed our house in the Guadalupe, almost every hour, pushing on to Gonzales. Then on a day there was a lull, and the tide turned. As these men passed to the front, they would stop for water and food, exchanging friendly gossip. But as they returned, they were greatly excited, halting only long enough to shout, 'The Mexicans are coming. Houston is making for the Trinity, the Sabine. Flee for your lives.' Then came the terrible news of the Alamo slaughter. The report was current that Gonzales was taken. All men, women, and children slaughtered, and the town burned. Of course, such sudden and appalling news created great excitement. The first law of nature, self-preservation, was utmost in the minds of the settlers, and thus the great exodus began. Soldiers often desert the army, but ours was a case of the army deserting the soldier. We may have been unduly excited. I know we were much chagrined when he arrived at our deserted army camp and saw the wild scenes of destruction about us. Under such exciting conditions, brother and I decided to hasten home to take mother and the children to a place of safety. We had caught the spirit of the occasion, and by the time we got home, we had a full case of runaway fever. Here we found the entire neighborhood in the throes of a great panic. A courier sent out by General Houston had dashed through the settlement, along the Guadalupe, the Navidad, and the La Vaca, warning the people to get out of the country with all possible haste. I will not attempt other than my own experience, with the observations of a few neighbors and comrades in this stampede. Many incidents, some tragic, some serio-comic, and which would make highly interesting reading, have, through the lapse of years, almost faded from my memory. We reached home about sundown and found Mother hastily preparing to begin her flight that very night. Some of the neighbor women were there, and they were all making haste to get away. Our presence gave much cheer, but it did not dispel the sad look depicted in every face. Just one little incident here will illustrate the state of feeling that prevailed at that juncture. Mother had prepared supper, and while at the table just at dark, the discharge of guns not far away was heard. "The Mexicans are on us," the younger women shouted, and their alarm for a while was extreme. Later in the night, it was learned that some of the men who lived below us on the river and who were coming home from the army to save their families had fired their guns merely to announce their arrival. It certainly created much alarm. It should be borne in mind that one of the chief causes of the difficulties and hardships experienced by the settlers in this flight was that the exodus was begun in the early spring, a season when the rain stock are in a weakened condition. No one in that section in that day provided feed for their stock through the winter. Horses on the open range were plentiful, but not having regained their flesh and strength on the tender spring grass, they were in no condition for the hard, heavy, and constant trudge. The only wheeled vehicle on our place was a cart with solid wheels sawed from a large log. This cart Mother had decided to use in the journey. We had several yoke of oxen on the range, but they too, like the horses, were in poor shape for such a trip. However, Mother had a 2 yoke of the best and gentlest steers that she owned driven up, corralled, and ready to be yoked at any moment for the start. On this cart, she planned to place a small supply of bedding, a pot and a skillet or two, and some provisions. Horses for the children to ride were staked near the house. It is said that panics, like the measles, are catching, and I must confess that after reaching home that evening and hearing so much of the danger that threatened us, I too became possessed with a burning desire to make tracks in haste. We explained to Mother that if we depended on these slow oxen, we could not hope to outrun the Mexican army, and that we might as well stay where we were and take our chances. "Boys," replied Mother, "we've got to start tonight, and we've got to use those oxen or walk." We finally prevailed upon her to wait until morning, when we would go out on the range and drive in the best horses we could find, for a more rapid getaway. By daylight we were out on the range, and by noon we had corralled a bunch of our best horses. In the meantime, and with feverish haste, Mother and the children had been preparing the packs for the journey. Finally, all was ready for the sad trip. It was about 3 o'clock in the afternoon when we bid goodbye to the old home, never expecting to see the dear spot again. It was not a palatial house. The furniture was scant and rude. There was no organ or piano, but few pictures and books. No carpets, but it was home in every sense to us. It was humble but very dear, and the children cried all evening, and that night till sleep finally came to their tired bodies. If Mother shed a tear, I never knew it, though there was an unusual huskiness in her voice that day. Mother was brave and resolute, and I heard her say to a lady while crossing the Brazos, under great difficulties, that she was going to teach her boys never to let up on the Mexicans until they got full revenge for all this trouble. When we left the old home, we barely took time to close the doors. There was a little corn left in the crib, a large supply of nicely cured bacon in the smokehouse, and the yard was full of chickens, turkeys, geese, and ducks, besides a good stock of hogs. All of these we left to the invaders. We had rigged up 4 pack horses. Besides, each member of the family carried all he or she could on their mounts. A few miles from home, we overtook 2 families from the upper settlement on the Guadalupe. They had an ox team and were making slow progress. They persuaded us to travel with them for mutual protection. That night, we camped on the edge of a dense post-oak woods, and Mother insisted upon taking her turn keeping watch. From the Lavaca, which we crossed a few miles below the present town of Hallisville, to the Brazos and even beyond, we were not out of sight of refugees. The country east of the Brazos was flat and low, and in many places, owing to the heavy rains, was covered with water. And here the real trouble began. People were trudging along in every kind of conveyance, some on foot carrying heavy packs. I saw every kind of conveyance ever used in that region except a wheelbarrow. But handbarrows, sleds, carts, wagons, some drawn by oxen, horses, and burros, old men, frail women, and little children, all trudging along. And though I have passed through the fields of carnage from Palo Alto to Buena Vista, I have never witnessed such scenes of distress and human suffering. True, there was no clash of arms, no slaughter of men and horses, as on the field of battle. But here the suffering was confined to decrepit old men, frail women, and little children. Of course, there were hundreds of incidents, tragic and otherwise, occurring in the course of the wild scamper over the almost trackless and rain-soaked prairies, and in crossing swollen streams. Delicate women trudge alongside their pack horses, carts, or sleds, from day to day until their shoes were literally worn out, then continued the journey with bare feet, lacerated and bleeding at almost every step. Their clothes were scant, and with no means of shelter from the frequent drenching rains and bitter winds, they traveled on through the long days in wet and bedraggled apparel, finding even at night little relief from their suffering, since the wet earth and angry sky offered no relief. Despite all this exposure to the elements, not one of our family suffered from sickness. And just here I want to record that more and greater humanity in its most exalted nature was displayed by these unfortunate people one toward another than I have ever witnessed. There were no strangers or aliens encountered along this terrible journey. All were friends, comrades, and countrymen, with that fellow feeling which endeared a feeling of wondrous kindness one towards another. A touching instance is cited. The mothers of Texas have loved to tell of how a widow with 4 little children whose father had perished in the Alamo was among the refugees, and that just after crossing the Colorado, the unfortunate woman became a mother for the 5th time. A family, having a rickety open wagon drawn by 2 lean ponies, gave the helpless mother a bed and transportation by throwing part of their belongings from the wagon to make room for a woman they had never seen before, and how, during rains by day or night, willing bands held blankets over the mother and babe to protect them from the downpours and chilling storms. Another incident I witnessed on this journey is recalled. A Texas mother whose husband was with the Army had strapped a feather bed upon her pony, fastened her oldest child on top, the next 2 on either end of the bed, and with her little babe in her arms, trudge along barefooted and at times so exhausted that she would sink down almost unable to rise and proceed. All through that fatiguing journey, through mud, slush, and places of tall, dead prairie grass, old men, frail women, and little children walked and suffered. But no one rode alone whose horse was able to carry double, sometimes 3 persons. It was no uncommon sight to see women and children without shoes and otherwise thinly clad, wading in mud and chilling water almost to their knees. When a cart or wagon became mired, which was an hourly occurrence east of the Brazos, there was no dearth of helping hands. But in proportion, the men were few, and so the women and children were forced to perform most of the labor. Thus, these half-clad, mud-besmeared fugitives, looking like veritable savages, trudged along. If there was sickness, tender hands were extended, and no morsel of food was withheld from the hungry. I heard of a few deaths during the flight, but did not witness any of these sad departures. I can say, however, without any question of doubt, that they had Christian burial in so far as circumstances would admit. And here I will relate an incident that goes to show the bravery of those Texas mothers. The story was told to me by an eyewitness, Captain J. H. Greenwood, who held a quasi-command at Fort Houston to watch the movements of the Indians during the war. When the great runaway set in, the captain conducted quite a party of settlers from that vicinity towards the Sabine. While the party was halting on the Angelina, a body of armed men rode up and camped. They were volunteers from Tennessee led by Captain Crockett, a nephew of Davy Crockett, en route to the Alamo. News traveled slow, and they had not heard of the fall of the fortress. Among the refugees were a Mrs. Moss and her invalid husband making the flight in an ox-drawn wagon. The volunteers were in need of transportation facilities and decided to impress Moss's fine yoke of oxen, whereupon the brave woman appeared upon the scene and, raising her pistol, said, "I will kill the first man that attempts to take my oxen." One of the men made a step forward when the plucky woman leveled her pistol and said, "Take another step and you die." And she meant it. Captain Crockett waved his men back and rode away. While these refugees were again halting near San Augustine, they were startled by a terrific cannonade in the town. The mystery was explained when some men came by at full speed, shouting at the top of their voices, "Hurrah for Texas! Houston has taken Santa Anna and his army prisoners." This made every man a hero and every woman an angel. People wept for joy and embraced each other, while many prayers of thanksgiving were offered up. In after years, it was my good fortune to know and to neighbor with some of the refugees in the runaway scrape, and I can testify that better and nobler men and women never lived. They were a type of pioneer fathers and mothers of Texas who have passed forever with that troubled time. Soon, after crossing the Brazos, we learned that General Houston had changed his course and was marching up the river. Anxious to know the progress of affairs in the field and realizing that every man was needed to help combat the invaders, I decided to leave mother and children with some friends in a secluded section of what is now Grimes County and to rejoin the army. Several other families, feeling a degree of safety, also halted in this vicinity, but the greater number of refugees pushed on, many never halting until they reached the Sabine and crossed over to the Louisiana side. Lieutenant Hitchcock, with General Gaines at Camp Sabine, reported that the temporary camp of fugitives from Texas, made of sheets and quilts spread from tree to tree, extended up and down the east bank of the Sabine for 20 miles, presenting a picturesque but painful spectacle. Securing fresh horses, which were had for the asking, we set out to overtake the Texan army. En route, we fell in with Captain Tomlinson and a few other settlers, and we all pushed forward with much haste. When we reached the smoking debris of Harrisburg, which had just been burned by the Mexicans, we learned the whereabouts of Houston's forces and the close proximity of the Mexican army to the Texan camp. Our horses were becoming greatly jaded, but we could not brook the thought of being too late for a fight with the expletive here. So we pushed on with all possible speed. In the afternoon of April 20th, when within a few miles of the seat of war, we heard heavy artillery firing and were quite sure the fight was on. It chagrined us deeply to think that we were not in the fracas. Spurring forward in a gallop, we reached the Texan camp near sundown and were overjoyed to meet our comrades and to learn that we still had prospects of engaging the enemy in real battle at any moment. General Sherman's men had just come out of a skirmish with the Mexican cavalry, and were entertaining groups of eager listeners with accounts of what they had seen and done while out reconnoitering. The general opinion was that a real fight was brewing, inevitable. On the eve of the battle at San Jacinto, General Houston had made a short talk, telling us that if we fought hard and won victory, we would all be captains. The fighting was indeed hard, the result a glorious victory that ensured the independence of Texas from a powerful nation. And of course, we all did feel like we were captains. The dictator of all Mexico was now an humble captive in our camp. The spoils of war were ours, and our joy knew no bounds. But after a few days of carousing, gadding, and gossiping, The novelty of the situation wore off, and we began to tire of idle camp life. Now that the campaign was ended and the Mexican army was overthrown, my thoughts were of peace, loved ones, and home. And so Josiah and I bid farewell to our comrades in camp and went back to mother and the children. The gladsome news of the great victory had already reached them, and what a change! It would be impossible for me to tell how happy the folks were. Those were the happiest days of my life. The forests and prairies were in full green and looked inexpressibly lovely. The birds seemed to sing a new song of gladness, and all nature appeared in holiday attire. In a few days, we were all on the homeward march, but the return trip was a very different one from the hurry-scurry runaway. Mother was as jovial as a girl at a ball, and the children were enlivened by a spirit of gaiety. The real secret was we were going back home. The Mexicans had been whipped, and we had nothing to fear at their hands anymore. As we pushed forward, the days seemed shorter, and the distance ahead seemed greater than ever before. We had only a small stock of provisions, jerked beef, parched corn, but we didn't feel the pangs of hunger. The night after we crossed the Colorado, floods of rain fell, and we became thoroughly soaked. But we didn't mind the rain. We were going home. We overtook many other refugees who were returning home, and they too, without exception, were in high spirits. We expected to find nothing but ashes and a heap of ruins where we had left our homes and shelter. But now this could be borne with resignation since Texas was free and the Mexican power was forever broken. Under the protection of our own rule and with the land at peace, we could soon rebuild our homes, replenish our herds, and as for the Indians, we could cope with them. I think it was on the 10th or 12th of May that we reached home late in the evening, and we found the house and the outbuildings intact. But the vandals had been there, and little of value remained. Fires had been made in the yard, feathers were scattered about the premises, and the bones of fowl scattered round told too plainly where mother's chickens had gone. Our rude furniture was broken, and the few books she had left on the side shelf were gone. The crib and smokehouse were empty. The doors were broken from their wooden hinges. The festering remains of old Lep, the faithful watchdog, were lying just inside the door of the dwelling. Whether he died defending the entrance or starved or was killed and his body thrown there will never be known. That night we repaired the old broken table, and at supper we gathered once more around the festal board, which was lightly burdened with a scant supply of dried beef, while our beverage was water, drunk from the Spanish gourd. But to us it was a joyful feast because we were at home. Next morning our joy was increased when we found that some of our neighbors had returned, and 2 weeks later they gathered from far and near at our house and danced all night. We were celebrating our recent great victory in the manner of that day and time. We were happy, hopeful, and willing to work hard now that we lived in our own free country. Privations were forgotten in the hope of better times. We made a very good crop of corn that year, although late in planting. Our stock on the range had not been molested to any great extent, and it took us but a few years to regain what losses we had sustained in the great runaway scrape.
You are listening to Texas History Lessons, a slow walk through Texas history made in Texas by a Texan for everyone everywhere.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Want to be more active this summer? Sierra helps you save on everything from swimsuits to stand-up paddle boards, tennis rackets to fishing tackle. And if that doesn't float your boat, we also have pool floats. Sierra, let's get moving. To your local store, like now. Go!
Okay, there we're going to end Creed Taylor's account of the runaway scrape. And some interesting content in there. And we could dive deeper into some of the things. You know, you got to remember he was recounting this in about the year 1900. This was several decades after the events, and he had some really colorful things to the way he expressed some things about his memories of that. But it's interesting. It's interesting to hear somebody that saw these events firsthand and what they encountered and what they saw. So that's going to do it for this time. I want to thank you for listening to Texas History Lessons. Thanks to Derek McLennan for providing the theme music, Walking Through History. You can check out his music everywhere you listen to and stream music. And if you get a chance, go see him play live, because he's playing all over the place. And that's it. Thanks again. Take care of yourself. Take care of each other. Be kind. Adios.